Welcome to House Judiciary. Today, we're missing and praying for our friends Representative Lynn and Representative Grunberg to enjoy good health, because without good health, everything else pales in comparison. And as such, we missed you, whose health faded rapidly last week. So we're happy that our prayers for you worked, and now we just want to reach out to God should bless Representative Lynn, and God should bless Representative Grunberg to speedily rejoin us here at Judiciary with their unique insight, which I miss, except for when it comes time to vote. In attendance are Representative Coghill, myself Ramirez, Vice Chair Dahlstrom, Representative Samuels, and Representative Holmes. And it is 5 minutes after one. We are going to take up two pieces of legislation today. We're going to begin with concurrent resolution number 15. It needs to be introduced, and then we will follow that up by taking up HJR 28. We are delaying testimony on HJR 27 until we are more successful in rounding up people that wish to discuss the merits of fiscal certainty. So that being said, I need somebody to introduce Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the CS for House concurrent resolution 15, version E.
Thank you. We have HCR 15 before us. And John, are you here? John Manley, John Bitney, to talk to us about this important piece of legislation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm John Manley. I'm with the House Majority Press Room. I'm here instead of Representative Harris, the prime sponsor of the resolution. He is on a panel at the AFL-CIO meeting. They're not able to attend. Also online, we have Eddie Grasser, the speaker and president's staff, who's well versed on this issue, and we'll chime in here whenever you'd like to. This is a relatively simple resolution. It asks the governor to have the attorney general in the DC gun rights case, the Second Amendment case, that is intended to, or we're hoping anyway, will delineate that the Second Amendment is an individual right to bear arms and not a collective right that can be easily regulated by government. And so my understanding that the Attorney General is planning on joining with the
Don't be nervous, John.
Okay, thank you. I didn't have my full complement of chocolate chip cookies, but I'm okay. Anyway, my understanding is that the Attorney General intends to file or sign on the amicus brief of the state of Texas in this case, which we found out over the weekend after this was introduced and scheduled for hearing. I think it's important for this to go ahead and go forth, though. It makes an important statement. If we need to amend it in any way that helps the Attorney General's case, I'm sure that Representative Harris would be most open to that. And that pretty much covers my statement. If you'd like to drill into the details, Eddie's the guy to do that with you.
Eddie, are you with us?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
How's it going?
I'm a bit tired. I was at meetings this weekend outside, and I didn't get home until 4 o'clock this morning.
Wow. What can you tell us about HCR 15 and the amicus brief?
I think that John covered the basics fairly well. This is a landmark lawsuit that's been going through the courts. the city of Washington, D.C. appealed the district the court opinion, which stated that the city of Washington did not have the right to unilaterally take all guns away from its citizens, which it had been doing because of the Second Amendment. So this is really a landmark Second Amendment case, and one that many people who support the Second Amendment have been looking forward to for some time. The decision will, I think, in some large part, lay to rest the question as to whether the Second Amendment supports the individual's right to keep and bear arms or not. I also, just to follow up, I think, Mr. Chairman, it's important, and members of the committee, it's important to note that this is an idea that's supported quite heavily in the state of Alaska. If you'll recall, the 1994 constitutional amendment passed overwhelmingly, making it clear that in our constitution, the state of Alaska's constitution, the right to keep and bear arms is an individual right.
Are there questions for Eddie, Representative Coghill?
Thank you. Eddie, help me understand what happened over the weekend. The Attorney General, in fact, did file it or said that they were going to, and trying to figure out how we might operate in the language of this particular thing to make it work properly.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, actually, Mr. Bitney and Mr. Manley could probably answer that question better than I. I was out of state this weekend at a meeting on the ESA listing issue of polar bears.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Chairman, I just had a note brought to me, and I'll digest that as well.
Yep. Other questions for Mr. Manley, Mr. Grasser? Thank you very much, Eddie. Is there a committee discussion? Is there anybody else in the room that wishes to testify on this issue? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to make a motion. I'd like to move the CS for House CR number 15, version E, with individual recommendations, and I do not see a fiscal note.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm only going to object for one comment, and that is if, in fact, there is something moving, I might ask for it to come to rules to amend the resolved section, that's all. And so at this point, I think it's too much in play to know that.
Okay. So noted.
Remove my objection.
Noted for the record. The objection is removed without any further objection. HCR 15 passes from committee. Thank you very much. John, good work. Eddie, thank you very much for your help.
John.
You're welcome, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Before us now is HJR 28. Representative Samuels, do you have somebody here who's going to testify on this issue, or do you want to do it from your seat?
I can do whatever you like, Mr. Chairman. It's just going to be me.
Okay.
HJR 28 is a great piece of legislation, just like Mr. Manley said about his, and I think we should just vote.
Simple little
a billion here and a billion there between friends. I'd like to start starting with the philosophy of the bill before we get to the actual words on a page. And the philosophy is, I think, that every person in this building and every person in this state has said, you've got this largesse of money right now, and you need to save it. And the political nature being what it is, it's not a good guy and bad guy thing. Budgets tend to go up, the needs tend to keep increasing. And my fear is that if we don't try to save this for long-term cash flow, and I mean long-term, we're talking generationally speaking, that if we do anything else with it, we can put it into the CBR, we can put it into different funds, but eventually, if the money runs out, you will just spend the money. Eventually, you're putting a day off. It's not. I mean, those are all good ideas. You know, put it into the CBR. The governor has a plan to create something in statute. But what HJR 28 does is truly a long-term savings plan that will spin out cash flow. It's a long-term cash flow mechanism. And the way that I have it working, it would go to a vote of the people. And if the people approved this piece of legislation, this constitutional amendment, we would take all of the money that is the progressivity tax on the severance tax right now. There's two separate taxes, as we all ad nauseum have learned. There are two pieces to the tax. All of the progressivity money would go into this fund. Your payout mechanism would be 4.5% of the total fund, which is actually a conservative number, and the permanent fund is here, and I think revenue is going to be here. You can argue whether it should be 4.5. Right now, a lot of large-scale endowments, such as Yale and the Ford Foundation, they're required by federal law to pay out at 5%, but most of those are also for charities. And by doing this payout methodology, what you will do is, over the long term, if the market is really good on where the investments are held, your payout will be up slightly, and if it is really down, like right now we've taken a hit lately, it's down, your payout will be a little bit less than that. But cash flow-wise, because you're taking this very small percentage of a very large number, your cash flow mechanism, it will always come into the general fund. The amendment, HR 28, does not say what that money gets spent on. I know that in previous discussions we've had some of it to municipal revenue sharing, some to education. I fervently believe that would be the role of the future legislature. That legislature can decide whether they want to increase education funding or put it into tourism, whatever they want to do with that cash, that is just simply a cash mechanism into the legislature. So there are, I'd like to compare it to a couple different ideas that have been, that are kind of been floated around, and then also to argue the other side of it, a couple of potential downsides that I see to doing it this way, one in particular. If we put the money into the CBR, which I think is a fallback position compared to this, what the CBR would do is you just put the money into the bank, and then when you need it, you pull it out. And you have a huge political fight, and that's all fine and good. That's kind of the way that it is built. But eventually that money would also be gone. You would simply just spend the CBR down to nothing. It is easier politically to have discussions on spending the CBR money than it is to talk to the citizens about revenue measures, whether they be income taxes, sales taxes, massive budget cuts as Sheffield had to do, or the permanent fund earnings, those types of things. It's easier to go to the CBR, so if you put it in the CBR, you're pushing off the day when those discussions have to take place, but eventually you will spend the money. So the CBR, it's not a bad place, and it's not a bad idea, and I know there are some specific bills floating around. You can leave the money in the general fund, and temptations being what they are, the budget would go up. I don't think anybody would argue that. You know, the best of intentions of all of us, we would all sit there and tell each other, I think we should all be fiscal conservative, and I think we should cut the budget except for what I want. And we all, I think, know that to be true. The governor has an idea which is actually similar to this, and I just don't think it goes far enough. She has an idea to take this progressivity money, put it into an account statutorily, and spin off, and I don't know exactly what the language is, but spin off 4.5 or 5% into a into the capital budget account. And after watching what happened to science and tech, when oil was at $20 a barrel, we went after the money. That's what we did. We went after the seed corn, and whether you agree or disagree, and that one had other problems with it, but if we're looking 10 years out and not 2 years out or 3 years out, if you're looking 10 years out, that money, because it's only statutorily protected, would also be at risk, and you could take it and spend the money. So with this way, the core of the money, the seed corn for the state, for this cash flow, is protected, but you always get some cash flow. It doesn't matter what the market does, doesn't matter what the political environment was, you would always have some steady cash flow. The only downside that I can see with this is that as production continues to decline, the price of oil will fluctuate, and maybe it goes to 150 and maybe it goes to 60. But as it continues to decline, you might get to the point where the money on the progressive portion of the oil tax is needed to balance today's budget. So do you want to be putting money in your savings account when your checking account is running dry? So what I would I put this bill out here to start the conversation, and the more that I thought about it, the more I like the idea, actually. It's now I really like it, is we could put a sunset on the, let's say, 5 or 6 years, where you don't have to, constitutionally speaking, put the money into this account. After 5 or 6 years, there will be a piece of follow-along legislation, which we won't hear in this committee, Mr. Chairman, but it'll be some of the cleanup, who manages the fund, and those types of things. And with that, you could also make sure in that legislation, if a legislature so chooses, they can always put other money into this fund. You know, a conversation that I had both with with Mr. McAllister, as well as I had with a member on the floor this morning, was why wouldn't you, instead of doing this, just restructure the constitutional budget reserve, and you'd automatically have your $4 billion in there, plus, you know, $1 billion from this, and you could actually start spinning some cash off, because you're not going to need the CBR this year or next year, probably the next, you know, 3 years, let's say, realistically. And you could restructure it all right now. What I would think I would rather do, and we did think of that when we were structuring the bill up together, is start this, put some money into it, and then the next legislature you can decide, you can just appropriate as a separate appropriation, as a separate debate, take the $4 billion from the CBR and appropriate it into this fund, setting up with this long-term cash flow methodology. Or the legislature might choose to say, I like the diversification, I like the portfolio. This over here is long-term cash flow. The CBR is short-term. That's my short-term savings account, if you will. If the price plummets, if we had a disaster, we need some cash on hand right now. You can get your hands on that $4 billion short-term. If we put it all in the CBR, I think we spend it. If we put it all in this, you're better for long-term cash flow. But you, in the short run, you might have a little bit more risk. So I guess my knee-jerk reaction, and the reason we didn't just restructure the CBR, is I kind of like having the diversified portfolio for the state. But other than that, I know that Jerry's here from Revenue and Laura's here from the Permanent Fund, and I've talked to both of them at length. And I appreciate their help on the nuts and bolts of how this would be managed, you know, how the cash spins off. But I'd be happy to ask any questions either on the language or the philosophy of where I was trying to head.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Samuels, is your intent that with this bill that the state would still pay the state back what we owe CBR and then start implementing this?
Through the chair, no. If this account spun off cash and the legislature wanted to appropriate that cash into the CBR, they could do that. It's just a long-term cash flow mechanism. And if you wanted to put other monies from the royalty money or whatever, because this doesn't take every bit of the surplus right now. Mm-hmm. If we wanted to put some of that into the CBR, we could do that too. This would start a separate fund for long-term cash flow.
Thank you. Representative Samuels, we've passed so many innovative taxes on the oil industry the last couple of years. I'm unclear on how much of it would be the progressive portion of the PPT. Who could help us with that? Is this something Jerry could assist us with?
Through the chair, I think Mr. Burnett or Sherry, I think she's here.
Okay, please, thank you.
They can talk about how much money is involved, roughly in rough terms, and they can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm talking about $1 billion this year in the progressivity, and then next year depends if you go with the current price of oil or the price forecast by Department of Revenue.
And what would be the effective date of this resolution if it were voted on by the people in November of this year? It would be effective for which fiscal year? For 2010?
Mr. Chairman, this would go back to the effective date on the tax bill. It would take all of the progressivity money, none of which is needed for today's budget.
So it would reach back.
It would retroactive take all of the money from back to June 30th, 2007 and put it in this account.
Okay, thank you. Hi. How are you?
For the record, my name is Sherry Nienheis. I'm a petroleum economist with the Department of Revenue, and that's correct. The amount that we forecasted for fiscal year 08 is about $950 million. And then going out on the fiscal note, you can see it's about $350 to $400 million per year for the remaining years on the fiscal note. That does assume the forecast that we have going out, which is generally around the $62 to $67 range. So, given our price and production forecast as of the fall of this year, 2007, you would have those $350 to $400 million for at least out through 2014.
All right. And Jerry, can you explain the fiscal note that you've attached?
Explain the zero ones first.
For the record, my name is Jerry Burnett. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Revenue, and there's two fiscal notes, one's from the Department of, or from the Tax Division and one from the Treasury Division. And so which one were you asking? My name is probably on both of them.
Both.
Okay.
Please.
Well, the fiscal note from the tax division, which is the one that talks about the progressivity surcharge, is the one that shows the numbers that Sherry referenced, $950 million in FY08 and 400, 350, 350, 400, 400, and 400 going out. And it shows them as a zero revenue effect with a change from general fund to a constitutionally dedicated revenue source.
Do the members have those in?
And then the second fiscal note, which is from the Treasury Division, prepared by Brian Andrews, and it shows our estimated investment cost of managing the money. And that's estimated based on those deposits to the fund from the tax fiscal note, and with approximately a 10 basis points cost to manage, which is approximately half of the cost of managing the permanent fund currently. It's less than our cost of managing Treasury, but we assume that this would be managed at a lower cost because it wouldn't include have a board like the ARM board. We could use some synergies with our management of other funds. Looking at the balance going forward, because I know you would probably ask that question, we're looking based on some estimates that I've done with a lot of assumptions in them. Looking at starting out, making the first deposit probably in January of the $950 million, and then further deposits going forth each year, so that by 2014, it has approximately a $3.1 billion balance and would spin off $152 million plus or minus that year at the 4.5%. We're doing this, and we would do this, we're making our assumptions based on earnings at the same rate as the PERS for the last 10 years, so I'm assuming a 9.51%. annual earnings and a 4.5% to get to that kind of a balance.
And I understand what you said, and for the benefit of anybody who doesn't understand basis points, 100 basis points would be
1%.
So 10 basis points would be 0.1%, but 0.1% on $1 billion, or $4 billion in this case, is a significant sum of money. And so would it be fair, Jerry, to say that this would be, relatively speaking, if you didn't trust yourself to have money in your checking account and you decided to put it into a savings account and the bank just charged you an arbitrary fee of $2 or 0.1% of the balance in order to maintain the savings account, that's the nature of that's the nature of the fiscal note. It's 0.1% to safeguard it from hungry legislation.
Chairman Ramirez, that is correct. And at the bank, on the other hand, you would see a statement that just showed you your earnings, and they wouldn't show you how much they charged you for it. And we have to budget the money within our budget to spend it. Even if we, you know, you could look at this as a net earnings situation and look at it at an 8.4% earnings rate instead of an 8.5% earnings rate. But we have to show actually our expenditures because the Executive Budget Act and the Constitution.
Okay. We've been joined by our friend, Representative Kelly, and you're welcome to join us up here. Our two members are absent. It's nice to see you. Representative Samuels?
Thank you. I had a question on the brokerage fee, essentially. When I'm a trustee on a 401k account, and we can choose whether the plan pays for it or the company pays for it. So in this case, it would be, do you anticipate that the fund pays for this, or is it a separate appropriation? And that would be something in the statute. I mean, my knee-jerk reaction is whatever you charge, it would just come out of the fund.
Just part of the rate of returns is a little tenth of a point less.
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, the way Treasury does with all of its funds is that it asks for an appropriation from those funds each year. So if you look at the retirement funds, you'll see that there is a component for investment management, and some of it's used for pay our staff, and some of it's used to pay external managers. But it is all shown as coming from those trust funds, or, you know, the CBR. There's an amount in the budget for managing the CBR each year.
Okay, so it'd be similar to that. So essentially, the rate of return of this fund would be a one-tenth of 1 point less. If you said you're making 8, really you're making 7.99.
Correct.
Counting the fees. Nothing wrong with it. And that's the way they all work.
Although, through the chair, it would show in our budget as a budgeted amount each year.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So can we do that under the language that we have in front of us? I'm looking at Section C, and it says an amount not to exceed 4.5% of the market value may be taken out. And then it says no other appropriations may be made from the fund. With that language in there, could we do what you're saying, which is basically appropriate money from the fund, manage the fund? Or do we need to change the language somehow to allow that?
To the chair, Representative Holmes, I'm not positive on that. I would assume that we could, in fact, manage it internally and have the manager fee netted out of the earnings. So maybe it wouldn't show in our budget in that case, and it would be an unbudgeted amount. But in any event, we would still be showing the costs in the fiscal note.
Jerry, we're very glad to have you before us. But if this money were not set aside, then it would be in the general fund. And in the general fund, it would cost 10 basis points less per year to manage those funds. But they would be at the peril of both bodies and the executive branch. Is that kind of the opportunity cost of the 10 basis points?
Representative Ramirez, if it were in the general fund, it would probably not be invested the same, because it would have to be held in shorter term securities or cash, so because it would be available for appropriation and spending at all times.
Mm-hmm.
So the general fund and other non-segregated investments, as we call it, GFONSI funds, are probably earning 3 or 4% per year, whereas long-term trust accounts, the sub-account of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Funds, which is amount set aside, which isn't used for annual cash flow, and retirement funds, other long-term funds, earn the higher rates.
So if we accept the premise that it will enjoy the same returns as the permanent fund, then arguably these funds would enjoy 500 basis points to the good, less whatever the management fee is. That's a fair way to look at it. It doesn't conform to the math of the government, but it's a...
Right. That is essentially correct, unless somehow you were to segregate money in the general fund and invest it long term, which, of course, we would not probably be making that choice, knowing that it could be spent at any time.
At any time.
It would be necessary to use for cash flow.
To your knowledge, you have great institutional knowledge. Have we ever done that? Have we ever segregated a portion of the GF money into higher earning asset class?
Representative Amherst, I'm not aware of going beyond maybe a 3 month investment or a 6 month or 1 year investment. You wouldn't go to a longer term. And then the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, as you recall, the legislature segregated a portion of that out for a longer term investment back in 1999.
So short term treasuries are 2%, 2.5% right now with the current Fed cut. So $1 billion invested at 2.5%. As opposed to the long-term earning potential of the permanent fund would be $50 million a year, and the easier access to the money for either the executive branch or the legislative branch.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Representative Dahlstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And these questions are for the sponsor, and I'm going to step back from some of the financial questions. Two things. Let's go back and talk about the CBR again for a minute. My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there was a commitment made that the money that was borrowed would be paid back to the CBR. There wasn't a time frame put on it. There wasn't a, you know, I mean, probably if the state wasn't the lender and the borrower, we would already be dinged pretty heavily for not having started making some movement towards paying some of this money back. Is that your understanding also that commitment was made?
Yeah, but if you talk about the philosophy of it, I'm proposing that we put, over the next 5 years, putting $4 billion into a savings account. Whether you call it the CBR or don't call it the CBR, the money's saved. So I think the people of Alaska, and I guess I can't speak for all of them, but the people of Alaska just want us to save the money.
Right.
Whether they put it in this account or that account, I don't think really matters too much.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. And I think there's some real merit to what you're saying, but if I understood you correctly, you almost talked about the wisdom. I think I heard you talk about the wisdom of having almost two accounts, that the CBR would indeed serve a specific purpose for getting money quicker, emergency, that type of thing, whereas the money that would be invested in this other area would definitely be there for us. We could get it, would require more votes, but we'd go through more of a process. So to me, I can see the need for both of them. I'm not settled in my mind with walking away from what I feel was a very strong commitment to pay the CBR back, and maybe, you know, before we start another one. I don't see why we can't do both of them. But
through the chair, if the fear would be if you try to do both, you'll run out of money. You'll fill up the CBR. As the production continues to decline, you'll need that money then just to pay today's bills. You'll never get to something like this, and then you'll just spend down the CBR, and it will all be gone. I'm talking 15 years from a long-term public policy. You won't have a cash flow mechanism like this. So having them both, one for some short-term cash needs, there's an emergency, the price of oil crashes, if there's a catastrophe and the pipeline is gone or whatever. You have short-term cash flow, but you also have some long-term cash flow, because if you just put it all in the CBR, in the next 6 years, I think Jerry told me in my office, we're talking $3 to $4 billion, but give or take, $3 or $4 billion, what will happen to production in the next 6 years before you won't put in any more money in the CBR? It will all be there, and then we will spend all of it.
Okay.
I mean, that's the fear. Whether we, if I could follow up with a question to Jerry.
Before you do that?
That's right. I'll let him go to the question.
The cash flow spin out on the first year in $1 billion is roughly $50 million. But in year one, we're not going to need the $50 million. So you can put it in the CBR. You could reinvest it in this fund. So the payout would actually tend to grow on itself also. And I understand you can't comment on what we're going to need or not need, but
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, if in fact you reinvested the money, and I didn't do a spreadsheet with reinvesting the 4.5% back in, but yes, that would increase your available payout every year.
And the legislature could either choose to do that or choose to take that cash payment and put it in the CBR. This is not taking all of the surplus the state has right now. The legislature could choose to take other sources of revenue and put that into the CBR. Mm-hmm. We're at $4 billion now, and what are we supposed to be at if we paid the IOU at 8 total?
8 something.
The chair, Representative Samuels, it's in that range. I don't know the exact number with me.
So there are still other mechanisms to try to do that. At the same time, still, 20 years from now would be 2029. This would be spending out $300 million a year with no reinvestment in the short term, and with a price point that, what's your assumption, 71, 68 or something like that, or 70 bucks a barrel?
For this year, it's about 72.
So $72 a barrel. That's, if that comes true and production continues to decline, this would still be in 20 years spending off $300 million a year with no reinvestment of short-term cash that spun out from it.
Okay. And then just to follow up, Mr. Chair, the first question I ask, and I know Representative Coghill has a follow-up on this, so we can come back to mine later, but have you given thought to, would this money be invested in Alaska, or are we going to invest it just wherever in the world that's going to make the greatest return? We've had that conversation with permanent fund earnings, and should it stay here and benefit Alaskans? And I'd just like to know what your thoughts are on that.
My thoughts would be to invest it as either the permanent fund, and I met with both Mike and Laura, or the Department of Revenue. I mean, I joked with Jerry. I says I'll take bids to whoever can do it cheaper, and apparently they're sitting here with the lowest bid. However, they invest the rest of the money for returns is what we would look at. I don't think we want to get into an account with $6 billion. We have political fights over who gets money invested here. We would invest it as they invest the rest of their funds.
Thank you.
Representative Kaka.
Just to the point of owing the CBR, whatever the amount is, it was expected that whatever was drawn out of it would be replaced, and that is constitutionally set up. That's why we have the sweep every year that we have to deal with on the appropriation issue, and that's how we install it by law. So if we have one fund that just pays the other fund, Alaska may end up watching us move all this big money around but not get really benefit. I don't know that would happen at this point, but that could be the way it'll go for the first $8 billion. I kind of like the idea of combining the CBR with the program you have, only because it goes to that big endowment issue you get a bigger, the bigger the basket you have, that means the 4.5 has a bigger volume base to it. But I won't fight you on that, because I kind of, your argument on the diversity issue
is good.
Is worthy of some consideration. But I have a question for the sponsor, changing the subject, and unless you want to answer some of that.
No, if you said you agreed with me, I'm good.
To the sponsor, Mr. Chairman. I'm not too sure I like the idea of putting a statutory provision in the Constitution. Have you, when you were drafting this, did that come up that you were going to reference that specific statute? I struggle with it, because we're reaching down into statutes, and now we're going to make it a constitutional issue.
I thought, through the chairman, Representative Coghill, I thought the same thing, and in a worst-case scenario, we start a tax fight on oil tomorrow, and it passes, and instead of having a base tax and a progressive tax, we switch to a gross tax, or we raise the base to 35 with no progressivity. What would happen to the money here? But my bigger concern was watching the production decline, and you're taking money constitutionally and putting it in the savings account. And maybe this is too big of an assumption, and I'd hear what Jerry has to say. I'm going to assume that the progressive nature of our tax system is not going to go away in the next 5 years. That's the assumption that I'm making here. Mm-hmm. Putting the deadline on when you constitutionally have to put the money in the account, I think is a good idea. And I think since you do that, we're not going to structurally change this tax system again in the next 5 years. Structurally, and I mean structurally, means you wouldn't have a progressive feature on oil taxes. And I did, it was a concern by having that in there.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to search for a different way to say it. I think this will be the first time we reference a statute in a constitutional section. Even the CBR goes a long way around describing how we're going to do it, but they stay away from the statute. And we should drive statute with the Constitution. I don't know that we should drive the Constitution with a statute. And so I'm going to do a little bit of study on it, and I would ask that you give me the opportunity to do that before we pass this out of here.
Through the chair, I'm all ears on the right amount. I'm telling you the truth, we drafted the bill. I didn't really talk to anybody, to be perfectly honest. I didn't call revenue. I didn't call the permanent fund. It sounded like a good idea. And I didn't know if the right amount was all this progressive money or not. And it turns out, I think it's not bad. The governor did the same thing statutorily. To me, it just didn't quite go far enough. But as it turns out, and just sheer luck of the draw, I'll be the first to admit that. I mean, I thought maybe it would be half, or maybe I'd need to do more. if there's another way to describe putting this amount of money into the account. And what it does, because of the statute, it's only when the oil prices are high and you're flush with cash on your royalty valuations also. So
yes.
Good luck.
I want to hear from Representative Holmes in a moment. I am a co-sponsor of this, and I do believe in it, but it's like writing an essay and using a fragment to convey your point, a sentence fragment. And so I think that the suggestion by the Rules Chairman, which I won't ignore, is that there shouldn't be any sentence fragments in our constitutional amendment. So I think given that, we will have some more conversation because the clock is our friend today, but I think it would be on another issue that you and I are priming, we had the same conversation with Don Bullock and about how a constitutional amendment should be written and whether it should be written broadly or narrowly on oil taxes, as a matter of fact, and how that relates. So I'm delighted to have a conversation today, but I think that's an important consideration. I think the computer would suggest there's a circular situation here with the statute inside of a constitutional amendment, as opposed to the other way around. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a number of questions trying to get my head around this, and luckily when you sit here and sit on your questions for a few minutes, some of the topics get touched on pretty eloquently before it even gets to you. So I very much second the Representative Coghill's thought about that. I had some questions about the Section B, just trying to get my head around it, Section B being the one that contains, well, I guess the statutory references in two different parts. But I was trying to get my head around Section B of the bill, which seems to be something of a sunset clause, but also then allowing a sunset clause for automatic deposits, but allowing for future deposits that are more or less voluntary. I'm struggling with what I think about this, because it says that after the effective date of the repeal or amendment of the progressivity
Can you direct clause. Us? Can you direct
Sorry,
us?
Sorry, I'm on page 2, line 1. The last line of page 1 and first line of page 2 is, it says that no deposits may be made to the production tax revenue fund under A of this section after the effective date of the repeal or amendment of AS 4355011G, which is the productivity or the progressivity clause. Just trying to get my head around what that means. You know, we've got a statutory reference in here. What if we go in and we this year decide that there was some little grammatical tweak that needed to be made to that section, or we decided to up it, or I mean, if we make any change to that section, if we were to pass this through both bodies, it wouldn't even go to the voters until this coming fall, become law at that point. By that time, who knows, we might have already made some tweaks. So
sure.
I'd like us to look at that section a little more closely. And
I'll remind you, Representative Holmes, that the state of Alaska has a stable tax regime when it comes to oil taxes, and we've only made three changes in the last 30 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand where you're trying to go with that, and I think it's good. I just have some concerns. It could be tomorrow. It could be 20 years. So if we have a certain number of years in which we want this to be, but I think that flows in very well with what Representative Coghill was trying to get to.
That's why I talked about the philosophy.
Good. Philosophies are good. So that was sort of my first concern, is making sure that we are doing what we mean to do in that section. Well, but I have like three other questions, if you don't mind, if I just... We got plenty of time. All right.
I will remind people watching on Gavel to Gavel, we're open for business, and we will take bills, and we are actively looking for them from both bodies, I think. So House Judiciary is ready to go. Yes, Representative Holmes?
Okay, next question. And this may be cleaned up if we end up another thing to look at when looking at the language. there seems to be a potential, we might need some of our friends at legal to answer this question for me. This bill in front of us would take the progressivity money and put the progressivity money into this fund. We have another constitutional amendment provision which says that all money received by the state through any sort of proceedings, litigation, et cetera, goes into the CBR. If we end up in litigation over progressivity funds, which trumps, which constitutional amendment trumps the other?
We'll ask the lawyers.
What did Les say?
We'll ask the lawyers.
We'll ask the lawyers. Sorry. I thought you said I'll ask the lawyers. That was not let the lawyers win.
They will be the big winners in that scenario.
Yeah. So that was one of my yeah. questions. I think I have two more. Another is the scenario you were discussing that possibly we could set up this fund and then come back a year or two later and just sweep all the CBR funds in. I'm not sure whether or not we can do that constitutionally.
Through the chair, you'd have to have another constitutional amendment
if
you chose to do that. You could just appropriate the money. If you can get 3/4 of the vote, you could appropriate the money, and the IOU is just bigger.
Okay.
If that's what the legislature chose to do and the IOU, you just owe yourself the money.
Seems like
that would be a question for a future legislature to decide, and there are pros and cons to it. It's all state money, and it's all saved. I'm trying to lock it up a little tighter than the CBR is locked up.
Just wasn't quite sure reading that as to whether we could. I guess that's one way to do it, a little inelegant, but a lot of what we do around here is less than perfectly elegant, so that wouldn't be the first time. The last point I had written down to start with was a point that...
Okay.
Yep.
If I could, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to point out, according to the chart here.
Representative Samuels, is that a chart that everybody has, or is that your secret magic chart?
It's a secret.
It is a secret chart. I can get it. You can get it copied. I'll give it to you to copy, and since I memorize this one number. When this account is at $4 billion, which would be the CBR number, at 4.5% payout, which I'll ask Mr. Burnett in a second if that is a right number or not, and I don't know if Laura's willing to talk about payout numbers. No, she's not. Okay. You'd be spinning off into the general fund $200 million, which we don't need right now, and then you could reinvest it, all that. So there are certain advantages to having the discussion, as you said here. I try to separate it into two issues. You can set up this fund now, and if you wish to do that one next, I didn't want to complicate things. People will freak out and they think you're destroying the savings account when actually you're trying to restructure it. It was an interesting decision. However, with $4 billion in there, you'd be spinning off $200 million, which you could then reinvest into this fund.
Thank you. May I ask you a question, please?
Sure.
President Clinton has been in the news lately. Which makes me recall what the definition of the word is. And so for the benefit of the committee, can you tell me what the definition of the word savings is? Save, to save, savings, because I've only been here for 3 years, but I'm not sure what that word means anymore.
Definition of savings is something you're going to earn today that you'll be able to live off into perpetuity.
So to follow on that, because my question is a serious one, actually. If with the decline, the pattern of decline in oil production, and the provision in HJR 28 that suggests at a certain point, as the way it's presently construed, at a certain point, the progressive feature may be used to cover budget shortfalls, then as we get this document passed out to us, is this less articulately said, a short-term savings plan that may only last 5 or 6 years, at which point the saved principal over that period of time then is not only inflation-proofed and spins off a few percentage points for the Treasury, but in fact, it's in essence a 5-year savings plan. I mean, it could be a 7 or 8-year savings plan, but it's a windfall profit savings plan.
I would think that is a good characterization. You're going to save this money and invest it, and you know, a family would think of it as you're investing this money for your kids' college education, but in reality, what you're doing, if you were the Kennedys or the Rockefellers, you would be putting this money up for your kids and their kids and their kids and their kids and their kids' college education, because you're always going to be able to spin off the cash, and you won't have the political argument of a legislature 10 years from now. If you get gas, it still doesn't cover our budget. Even if you get a gas line and in 4 and 5B, it still is not going to cut it. You will not be able to tap this money, and it would be to the chagrin. You will, people sitting in these chairs 15 years from now will go, gosh, those guys should have just let us spend the money, because, and then the people 15 years after that will be happy that they got the $300 million spinoff. I mean, it is an endowment as if you were the Ford Foundation, and not thinking that today is the most important need in the world, that you're thinking long-term for the cash.
So to my point, there are those worksheets that show that if you were 20 and you save $2,000 a year into your IRA from when you were 20 to 25, and then you didn't save anything from 25 to 65, you're still far better off than if you started saving $2,000 a year when you turned 40 and saved until you were 65. Is it that approach in a nutshell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm so glad I'm a co-sponsor of Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question probably for our friends at Revenue and possibly the Permanent Fund. The way this is drafted, it says that an amount not to exceed, and I'm on line 5 of page 2, I believe, an amount not to exceed 4.5% of the market value of the production tax revenue fund on the last day of a fiscal year may be appropriated from the fund during the immediately following fiscal year. I understand in year one why this is a good idea. There's only 1 year's worth of investments to look at. But assuming that we're setting up a constitutional fund for it to, and for the sponsor as well, of course, what his thoughts are. Assuming we're setting up a fund that's going to last for quite some time, 5 years out, 8 years out, are we still going to be wanting to look at only one budget year, or would we be better off with more of a 4 or 5 year average?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, it's typical in endowment funds to look at some kind of back-looking average, whether it's 1 year, whether it's 2 years or 5 years. That protects you against a year where maybe the stock market zooms up and your investments earn 18 or 19%, and then the next year they go down and you actually have a lower market value. So, you know, like with the permanent fund with the dividend payout, where you're looking at 5 years of earnings, mm-hmm. that you, it's typical for endowments to look at some number of years back. And on that same point, it's 4.5% is in this, and you'll see endowments that are 4.5 or 5, 5.5%. And what you're trying to achieve with that percentage is the real inflation-adjusted rate of return over time. So if we think the PERS funds earn an average of 8.5%, they're earning somewhere around 5% after inflation, a real rate of return. And so by using an amount of 4.5 or 5, and I don't know what the right answer is to that, but some number in that range, and then you're looking at using a back-looking average of some type for prior years, and then you try to, the real value of the fund is maintained even when you're not putting further deposits into it.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm certainly amenable to whatever the best mechanism is to work the way that an endowment works. I mean, it,
Representative Coghill, and then I have a question.
Representative Holmes, we went round and round on that discussion on the percent of market value issue when we talked about the permanent fund, which reminds me that the permanent fund also is not endowed. And this could work one of two ways. It could work to prove that an endowment is, in fact, a good way to go, or it could cause us to never bring the discussion up again. And I don't know that either one of them really is the right answer. It's just that if we ever chose to go through the endowment process for the permanent fund, this may be one reason not to do that. I'm trying to think. I'm thinking out loud now, but as we have that discussion, and that brings me to the point of why wouldn't we have the CBR and this joined together? And I'm trying to think of my own personal family situation where there might be times where I'll have a money market account where I might want to just take whatever earnings I can and leave the money in to earn, and there might be times where I'll have the checkbook, and then there'll probably be times where I'll have money locked away that is not to be used until retirement. So you can make that case for state government, I suppose, here with the permanent fund being one type and CBR being another type. So, but if you're going to get the bang for your dollar in an endowment fund, certainly the bigger the endowment, the better. But this purpose here, I'm going to have to think how number one, you could put them together, or even if you could institute this, leaning heavily on a statutory provision. And so, as we begin to look at it, and I take it and really just kind of chew on it, think about it, I like the idea of taking CBR and endowing it. But then the earnings become a majority vote issue. But I have found in my years here that the three-quarter vote was a hurdle that made you negotiate more, but it didn't save any money, I don't think, personally. So the negotiation would be at a different level. But we are going to need something to carry us from oil to gas if we ever get that far down the road. And the other question is, and I suppose listening to the sponsor talk about this, he's open to discussion. If you institute this in the Constitution now and then try to come back and combine them later, then I think people think you're up to something. So if there's a way that we can describe the revenue stream from the revenue stream that you've proposed here, that becomes a steady revenue stream into a endowment fund that would swallow up the CBR, I think people would be disposed to that as long as they could see it clearly. So I guess I lean in that direction, as you can see.
I tried to keep them separate on purpose.
I know, and I keep running you into it.
I just don't know if the legislature could swallow it all at one time, talking about both, and having both has advantages, really does.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just for the free-flowing part of the discussion, I'm thinking about the general population that says, okay, in our Constitution we have several funds, and we have a spending limit, and the CBR is not being paid back, and the spending limit is ineffectual.
I've got one drafted in my office if you want to see it.
So I'm just trying to think of people having the integrity for their Constitution that they really deserve, and to see it as simply as they can. And so that's part of the discussion that I'll have to answer in my own mind before I really get on the bandwagon with it.
Sure. I still don't think, though, it's a bad thing to have different mechanisms for different purposes. This is, like I said, I keep saying, it's a cash flow mechanism. I mean, you could put, and I'd hate to put this specific things in the Constitution, and I did sit in here talking, it says, okay, the first 5 years of the earnings must go into the CBR. And that means that it can't go to the general fund. Well, that's good and fine until the price of oil is $60 a barrel, and we wish we weren't putting in one fund to sit there and have a vote to take it back out the next day. I mean, so there's, you know, to do away with the CBR, I think, causes more discomfort in the public to say we're going to do away with this short-term savings account. And by keeping it there, it has certain advantages.
I'm easily persuaded on that. I'm actually thinking more in terms of the bang for the buck on what a 4.5% payout might look like if you had $8 billion rather than a billion.
Although, since you're not for the next 2 years, and who knows what the price of oil does tomorrow and the production does here and there, you're not going to take this money anyway for the next 2 years. So the CBR, you're not going to go into the CBR anyway. You're not going to be needing this money anyway. So it's growing right now. And in CBR, you said, is you invested a little bit differently. And is that a statutory change? I mean, if we want told you for the next 2 years, invest. But if you're talking about investing long-term, 2 years is not long-term. So I sure would hate to have invested a whole $4 billion 8 weeks ago and then need it tomorrow. That wouldn't have played well.
To the Chair, Representative Samuels, Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund is segregated into two accounts right now, the main account and the sub-account. And the sub-account is invested long-term. In fiscal year 2007, it earned 15%+ return. The rest of it earned in the 4.5%. So we would, you know, if the CBR grows, we will segregate it and invest so that we maintain an ability to have cash flow and maximum returns.
One other point, Mr. Chairman, and then I know you had some. Obviously, the statutory language has a problem with me. I can envision a place where we have all of this attention, this whole the weight of this particular fund falls on one statute, so it might have a huge impact on how we begin to have discussions on just the statutory provisions, because you kind of pinpoint this one and nail it down, and then all of our discussion would rotate around how do we fix our other statutes so that this one, you know, and that may be good or it may be very, very bad, and I hadn't really thought about it in that regard. Have you?
Through the chair, we knew that having the statute in the bill was going to be somewhat problematic, and we can certainly find other ways to do it. I mean, the worst case scenario that I thought was a bill is introduced to change this completely site to a different mechanism to do whichever politically expedient at the time. A governor, a legislature decides that they don't want this money in, or they want more money in, so they just change, they put an extra letter in there, and something else becomes G. And I don't know how big of a concern those are, but I can get the questions answered to Representative Holmes' questions as well as that, and try to find a way to not have the site in there if possible. Although we know what we want to do, it's the same thing that the governor has done to set up the transportation statutorily within the general fund. And I don't know how it'll be invested under that scenario or not, but it's the same idea. So I'll look at that language and I'll get with the lawyers and try to hammer out some of these questions. As I said, the philosophy on day one.
Mr. Sponsor, as the Judiciary Chair, I'm struck by the fact that we got this committee referral because this is a constitutional amendment. And it's appropriate that we see it. But I can't help but be struck by the fact that were we a board of seven and with a room full of of concerned members of our organization, that we would be in the business of financial planning right now for our household, for our state, for our entity, our organization, whatever that it was. And I recognize that with constitutional amendments, and I'm only pontificating because it's 10 after 2, but because we have shown such a gross inability to save in my short tenure here in the legislature, we are, appears to me, making the desperate attempt to make a constitutional amendment to force ourselves to conform to some degree of savings. And if I look at the woeful condition of the growth of government, which was refined and the subject of some discussion at the end of last week in our body's finance committee, in a dust-up with the administration, as to the rate of that growth, which is in the range of 4% or 15% or 27%, depending on whether you accept Ms. Rayfield or House Finance or Representative Dugan, who I read has defined it as high as 27%. And our problems are, we can't pretend to know what our problems here are in the year 2020 or 2034, and if we could make this decision without having to have an easily discernible constitutional amendment before the people, we would really be best off, structure-wise, arguably, to save money for the next 5 years and then to create an annuity that pays out over the ensuing 10 years so that we create a bridge of sorts and have a sum of money that we didn't spend into infrastructure or social service projects that would allow the state a time horizon of 15 years to get to a second revenue stream, because the difficulty, and I say this as a sponsor of HJR 28, but the difficulty with this is that it treats the state of Alaska as a trust baby in perpetuity that can never be trusted with the principal, and which is the sad nature of the cynicism with which you drafted this, and I happily co-sponsored it. It's a cynical in its construction, I think, and draws the balance out to the year 2034, when presumably, depending on how able the legislature and the executive branch, how adaptable those two bodies are, and what kind of elasticity we see from those who hold the leases on the gas, and the ability of those partners to get together, the real bridge for Alaska is the next year 6 through year 15. By your own admission, we're pretty solid for the next few years, but boy, year 6 through 15 has us exhausting the CBR, whether it's refunded with a hyphen in there. The progressivity, the PPT, declines in order to meet the budget shortfalls, and by the rosiest expectations, we still don't have a second income stream for the state of Alaska. So the year 2034 isn't the problem. The problem is right out there after the year 2014. I mean, were we to approach this to solve a problem rather than to solve the state's more endemic problem, that's what we ought to be narrowing the constitutional amendment. But there's no way in 7 lines or 10 lines that you can, you know, distill that, but for what it's worth.
My fear is exactly that in year 7, 6 years from now, and none of us are here. Maybe the young one is, but.
And Max, and I'd like to, God bless Representative Gruenberg, he should still be here.
When none of us are here anymore, if that money is available to be spent, it will be in year 6. Or even if we're flush with cash 4 years from now. And it's not that there's bad legislators or a bad governor or any of this thing. It is the nature of the beast. And if you look at in the year 2034, this will make times a little bit tougher for a short period of time in year 7 through 10. But if you don't do this, along comes year 10, you had an easy 3 years there, and the money's gone. You just spent it. We will spend the CBR. We can put it in the CBR, but then we're going to take it right out of the CBR. You can put it in a statutory fix, which I think is a good idea. It just doesn't go far enough. You can put it in there, and when it comes time to having to make some difficult choices, you'll just spend it. The legislature or a governor and a legislature, it doesn't matter who's in charge, it doesn't matter which party, it doesn't matter. It'll be easier to spend it than to go get money somewhere else. And then 20 years from now, you've got nothing left. The money is gone. It's not cynical. It is good financial planning.
Yes, Jerry.
Chairman Ramos, I just wanted to make one comment. You were given a copy of a spreadsheet that I gave to the sponsor earlier, and that is a non-sophisticated spreadsheet. I just wanted on the record that that is not something that we've tried to get anywhere. You can keep it, but it only shows the progressivity going in there for the first 5 years, and we did not attempt to do that or to match cash flows exactly to it. So it was a very simplistic model.
Absolutely. Thank you for acknowledging it, but understood. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a mechanical question here of how this would work. The timing of the, everyone's favorite word, retroactivity of the constitutional amendment combined with the need to do budgeting for this year. I'm just trying to figure out how this would play out. If this legislation were to pass both bodies, it wouldn't go to the voters till the fall. So we wouldn't know until, and we do our budget cycle in the next couple of months for this year, for FY08 or FY09. And then here we are, we find ourselves in the fall, say this passes, both bodies passes, and then all of a sudden we've already taken the money from June 30th of 07 to June 30th of 08, and we've stuck it in the CBR, or we've stuck it in a transportation fund, or we've stuck it somewhere.
Where we spent it.
We spent it. Then just thinking through the mechanics of how we go back and stick that year's worth of money into a fund after we've already put it somewhere else.
I would trust Mr. Burnett's answer on this, but I'm assuming that the budget passes on the last day of the session. We'll see if this has passed by then. If it has passed, he sticks the money somewhere and sees if it passes a vote of the people. We don't need it to balance the budget. If there are other things being done with it, this will become a moot point. But I think those things will work themselves out as we go through the process.
Yeah. But yes. That would be something to keep in mind as we're going through our own budget process.
The state of Alaska needs a 12-step program. And I don't know what other states it should get with, but in order to participate in that meeting, but the fact that we have to contemplate a constitutional amendment, and as I say, I'm a supporter of it, is indicative of our inability to
control,
be good stewards of the immediate resource. I mean, we spent so much time talking about cultivating the resources that are in the ground, mineral resource and the petroleum resources, and here we have the most readily available resource, and this constitutional amendment speaks to the fact that this is the resource that we least are capable of managing, because we need a constitutional amendment. Fish and game aside, the AOGCC aside, DNR aside, Department of Revenue aside, who is the good steward of our $7 billion windfall? It strikes me as interesting. Any other thoughts on HJR 28, Representative Cockham?
Just a thought. And first of all, I want to thank the sponsors for bringing it forward. I think It is a worthy discussion. I probably wouldn't characterize it as our inability. I think it really is a look forward to saying, okay, we are anticipating this now that it's been put into law, and can we manage it for better outcomes? And so, although I've been critical of the legislature and spending, so I've got to be careful how far down the road I go.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I took my lessons from you, President Coghill.
But at the same time, I think I will give it the perspective look. I think it's something worth looking at. So, notwithstanding some of the technical issues of both litigation, statutory provisions, and things like that, I think philosophically, I'm with the sponsors on this.
I could, no more questions. My to-do list is to talk about seeing if there's other ways to get the statute listing out of there. And also the question that did not come up is the 4.5%. It's a conservative number. Mr. Burnett has said 4.5 to 5.5. And Laura, do you mind commenting on maybe the what the permanent funds, if you comment on other endowments, kind of what they do, what the range we're talking about for the payout is on funds that you're familiar with?
Sure. For the record, my name is Laura Ashe. I'm the Director of Communications for the Alaska Permanent Fund. You may be interested to know that recently we discussed a payout method similar to this. I can tell you that every private foundation in the United States is required by the IRS to pay out 5% each year. Rasmussen, Ford, Pew Charitable Trust, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, they're all required to pay that out. Colleges have a range. We actually, a number of years ago when the trustees were first looking at this issue, we looked at a paper that talked about what the long-term effects of different spending rates are. It's a balance between how much of the money do you want earlier on and how much do you want long-term. If you start off at 4%, you get much more out of the fund over its life than you do if you start off at 6%, even though you don't get as much on the front end. So it's just simply a policy question of where you want to land on that. The question came up earlier about averaging. Again, it's a policy question. How conservative do you want to be in your payouts? Do you want to average them, or do you want to go with a straight number? And these are just all questions for you to decide.
Okay. All right, very good. We didn't have anybody who indicated that they wanted to offer public testimony other than the Permanent Fund and the Department of Revenue. I think we will leave public testimony open. We will hold this bill over pending an opportunity to draft it a little more broadly so that perhaps we can better address the statutory reference, and I think that would enhance the bill's opportunity of succeeding as it moves through this building, and we will make an effort with the sponsors' cooperation to pass out a revised draft of HJR 28, and then try and notice this to see if there is any public comment, because the public nobody from the public weighed in on this, but it is of some considerable interest, since it is the savings and the surplus of the state of Alaska. So I think that we will try and address it in a constructive fashion in that way. So with that, public testimony is it will still be available. We will look forward to the opportunity for a revised draft. We'll take up HJR 28 again. All the members, with the exception of Representative Gruenberg, have signed off on House Bill 317, which is the Compassionate Gifts bill, although I would like to be on the record saying I'm with Dermot Cole, a writer for the Daily News Miner, who suggested that you cannot put a value on human organs, but Alaska Air Miles and the other elements that surround the care that we all want to provide for our colleague, and as a matter of esprit de corps, are important. So we will get a ruling from the rules chairman or Ledge Legal on how we go about getting Representative Gruenberg's signature, who I'm sure would have a great deal of empathy today for Representative Foster. And And so with that, at 2:25, thank you very much, Sherry and Jerry, for your testimony, Laura. So at 2:25, we're adjourned for the day.